Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, you and I are going to look at a medical text that feels, well, a bit like trying to crack an impossible bank vault.
Oh, yeah. A vault that's been buried for decades.
Exactly. You know, when we normally think about modern medicine, we tend to picture these incredibly precise, high-tech solutions, like a master locksmith smoothly picking a lock.
Right. You find the keyhole, you put in the exact right tool, and just click.
Click. The door opens, the disease is treated. We really want it to be clean like that. But then you look at certain types of cancer, specifically pancreatic cancer.
Yeah. That's where the locksmith analogy just completely falls apart.
Right. Suddenly, it's not an elegant lock anymore. It's a vault that has been welded shut, it's buried under 3 feet of solid concrete, and historically, almost every single key we've tried to put into it just snaps right off in the door.
It really is. The historical landscape of treating this disease is notoriously grim. It's one of the most difficult, stubborn vaults to crack in all of oncology, honestly. For a very long time, many researchers thought getting inside was nearly impossible.
But we are looking at a clinical study today on a new drug that's attempting to do the impossible. We're pulling from excerpts of a highly specialized medical report, and it's titled Daraxonrasib Efficacy in RAS-Mutated Pancreatic Cancer Therapy.
Yeah, and I know daraxonrasib is a massive mouthful.
It really is.
The report also refers to it a lot by its developmental name, which is RMC-6236.
RMC-6236.
Right.
Right. So our mission today is to decode all this clinical jargon for you, look at the actual hard data they've published, and really understand whether this drug represents a genuine turning point for patients.
Because we have to balance things, right? The incredible hope of shrinking tumors against the very stark reality of severe side effects.
Okay, let's unpack this. Before we can even look at the results of the trial, we first need to understand the enemy that this drug was actually built to fight.
Yeah, you have to know what you're up against.
Right. So the report starts by setting the stage, noting that current therapies for patients with pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma, or PDAC for short, provide only what the authors call modest benefit.
And modest benefit is one of those clinical euphemisms that masks a lot of human tragedy.
Yeah, it sounds so polite.
It does. But what they are saying, in very polite scientific terms, is that our current standard of care just doesn't work very well. Or, you know, it doesn't work for very long.
Because the standard treatment is usually chemotherapy.
Right. Traditional systemic chemotherapies. These are drugs that essentially carpet bomb the body. They attack rapidly dividing cells without much prejudice at all.
They just take out everything in their path.
Exactly. Yeah. And because they aren't highly targeted, the survival rates for pancreatic cancer have historically remained just very, very low compared to other cancers.
Which brings us to why this cancer is such a welded shut vault. The text points out something crazy. It says that over 90% of PDH tumors have activating RAS mutations. Over 90%. I mean, that is a staggering majority.
It is. In the world of oncology, finding a single mutation that is responsible for over 90% of a specific type of tumor is huge. It gives you a massive neon target to aim at.
Okay, so what is this RAS mutation doing?
Well, the RAS gene is supposed to act like a normal part of your cellular machinery. Its job is to help cells know when to grow and, crucially, when to stop growing.
Right.
So an activating mutation means something has gone fundamentally wrong with that specific instruction manual.
The way I was visualizing this when I was reading the source, it's like a broken, stuck-on switch in a factory.
Oh, that's a good way to look at it.
Yeah, like normally the foreman flips the switch on, the machinery builds a few necessary cells, and then they flip the switch off. But this activating RAS mutation means someone took a hammer, smashed the switch into the on position, and now the factory machinery is just endlessly, uncontrollably pumping out bad cells.
And you just can't turn it off. And the frustrating thing is, for decades, scientists knew about this broken switch. They knew the RAS mutation was driving the cancer. But they just couldn't figure out how to drug it.
Why not, if they knew it was there?
To understand why it was considered undruggable, you have to picture what a protein looks like on a molecular level. Traditional drugs work by finding a physical pocket or a crevice on the surface of a bad protein and wedging themselves into it.
Like our key fitting into a keyhole.
Literally like a key in a keyhole. But the shape of this mutant RAS protein is almost perfectly smooth. It's like a microscopic billiard ball.
Oh, wow. So there's nowhere to grab onto.
Exactly. There were no pockets. There was nowhere for a drug to grab hold. The keys just kept snapping in the lock.
Okay, so if the mutant protein is as smooth and featureless as a cue ball, How did these researchers finally get a grip on it? Like, what does this new pill do differently?
Well, the report describes daraxonrasib as an oral RAS(ON) multi-selective inhibitor that targets guanosine triphosphate-bound mutant and wild-type RAS.
Okay, wow. That's a lot of clinical jargon right there.
It is. Let's break down the mechanics of that dense description. We need to start with guanosine triphosphate-bound.
Okay, what is that?
Guanosine triphosphate, or GTP, is basically the energy source. The broken factory switch doesn't just spark on its own, right? It needs energy.
Right, it needs power to run the factory line.
Exactly. And when GTP binds to the RAS protein to supply that energy, an amazing physical interaction happens. The protein actually changes shape. It flexes.
Wait, it flexes?
Yes. And for a brief moment, when it flexes, a tiny microscopic crevice opens up on its previously smooth surface.
Oh, so it creates its own temporary keyhole.
It completely exposes a vulnerability. And this new drug, RMC-6236, is carefully engineered to act like a highly specific wedge.
Just waiting for that exact moment.
Right. It ignores the inactive versions of the protein. But the moment the mutant protein binds with GTP and flexes open to start pumping out cancer cells, the drug wedges itself perfectly into that newly formed crevice.
Jamming the gears so the factory line stops.
Exactly.
So it's looking for the switch only when it's actually sparking. That's incredible. But the text also uses the word multi-selective. What does that mean in this context?
Well, cancer is notoriously chaotic, and genetic typos rarely look identical in every single patient. A multi-selective inhibitor is capable of recognizing and jamming multiple variations of this broken switch.
So it's not just a one-trick pony.
No, it doesn't just work on one hyper-specific subtype of the mutation. It actually covers a broader spectrum of these smooth proteins when they flex open.
And, you know, the delivery method here is fascinating to me, too. It's an oral medication. It's just a pill.
Yeah, a daily pill.
That sounds incredibly simple compared to the complex molecular engineering going on. But practically speaking, that's a massive shift, isn't it?
It completely changes the daily reality for the patient. I mean, we talked about systemic chemotherapy earlier. That usually involves going to a clinic, getting a port accessed or an IV inserted, and just sitting in a chair for hours.
Your whole life just revolves around being at the hospital.
Exactly. A patient's life begins to revolve entirely around their infusion schedule. So taking an oral medication at home represents a huge return of autonomy.
So just to recap, we have an oral pill designed to wedge into a microscopic crevice that only appears when the protein flexes, shutting down the switch that drives 90% of these pancreatic tumors. Mechanically, it sounds miraculous.
It's a brilliant piece of engineering, for sure.
But taking a concept from a lab and putting it into a human body is where biology gets really messy. We need to look at how the researchers tested it in the real world.
Right, because the first hurdle any new drug has to clear isn't just whether it stops the cancer, but whether it is actually safe for the human body to endure.
Yeah, and the source outlines a phase 1-2 study involving patients with advanced solid tumors that have these RAS mutations. The patients received doses ranging from 10 milligrams all the way up to 400 milligrams daily.
And they eventually selected 300 milligrams as the dose for the next phase, phase 3.
Right. Why start so low and go so high?
Well, a phase 1-2 trial has a very specific primary objective, and as the text states, that primary endpoint was safety. Starting a patient on 10 milligrams and slowly climbing the ladder all the way to 400 is, well, it's a highly monitored tightrope walk.
They're looking for the sweet spot.
They're looking for the Goldilocks zone. If the dose is too low, it won't effectively wedge into enough of those crevices. The cancer keeps growing.
And if it's too high?
If the dose is too high, the drug might start interfering with normal, healthy cellular machinery, causing unacceptable toxicity.
So they basically push the dosage up to see exactly what the human body can tolerate.
Exactly. To get the maximum cancer-stopping effect, they observe the fallout at 400 milligrams and then dial it back to 300 milligrams to lock in that optimal dose.
Okay, so this report specifically focuses on 168 patients who had previously treated RAS-mutated pancreatic cancer and who received that 300 milligram dose or less.
Right, the specific pancreatic cancer cohort.
And this is where the data demands a serious pause. The safety data shows that 96% of these patients experience treatment-related adverse events of any grade.
Yeah, 96%.
And 30% experience grade 3 or higher. Wait, almost every single person in this 168-patient group had an adverse event, and nearly a third had a grade 3 or higher event.
It's a tough reality to look at.
That sounds incredibly brutal. We are talking about rash, diarrhea, nausea, stomatitis or mucositis, vomiting, and fatigue. At what point does the cure become as grueling as the disease?
And that right there is the central agonizing tension of oncology. But we do need to provide a rational context for these jarring numbers.
Okay, help me understand why 96% isn't an immediate deal breaker.
A 96% rate for any grade adverse event is actually pretty common in oncology trials. The any grade category captures every single physiological hiccup.
So it's not all life-threatening stuff.
Not at all. It includes very mild things like a slight rash that clears up with an over-the-counter lotion or just a fleeting wave of nausea. It sounds terrifying on paper, but it covers a lot of minor inconveniences.
Okay, so it's a catch-all bin for literally everything. But that 30% number.
Yeah, the 30% experience in grade 3 or higher is what oncologists watch like hawks. Grade 3 events are medically severe. They often require hospitalization or significant medical intervention.
The text mentions stomatitis or mucositis as one of these side effects that occurred in at least 10% of patients.
Hmm.
Break down what that actually feels like for someone taking this pill at home.
Well, the clinical term mucositis sounds fairly benign, almost like a stuffy nose or something.
Yeah, it sounds like you just need a decongestant.
Right. But in reality, it means severe inflammation and ulceration of the mucous membranes lining the entire digestive tract.
Oh, wow. The entire tract.
Yes. Practically, a patient develops painful open sores in their mouth and throat. It makes it incredibly difficult to eat, to drink water, or even to just swallow the very medication they are trying to take.
That sounds horrific.
It is. Combine severe mouth ulcers with gastrointestinal distress, like severe diarrhea and vomiting, and you are looking at a profound, exhausting physical toll that significantly degrades daily quality of life.
It's punishing. Why do scientists and doctors, and most importantly, the patients themselves, endure a 30% rate of severe life-altering events?
You have to go back to the baseline we established at the beginning. These 168 patients are described as having previously treated advanced pancreatic cancer.
Meaning they've already tried everything else.
Exactly. They've already run the gauntlet of standard chemotherapy. Those standard treatments have failed, and their cancer is actively advancing.
I see.
When a patient is facing a highly aggressive, historically fatal disease with literally no other options, the tolerance for severe side effects shifts dramatically.
It's a calculated, desperate risk.
Yeah. A 30% rate of severe toxicity is accepted because the alternative is letting an aggressive cancer run unchecked.
You're basically accepting a known quantity of suffering in the hopes of stopping an otherwise unstoppable force. Okay, so knowing the heavy physical toll Durex and Rezabib takes, we have to look at the secondary endpoints of the study, pharmacokinetics and anti-tumor activity. Did the physical cost actually buy these patients anything?
To see that, we can look at how the report breaks down the efficacy data by grouping patients based on their specific genetic mutations.
Let's look at the first subgroup then. The researchers isolated 26 patients with a specific mutation called RASG12 who received that 300 milligram dose as a second-line treatment. Did the pill actually shrink the tumors for this group?
It did, yeah. The text reports an objective response in 35% of these patients.
Okay, 35%. What does objective response actually mean in a clinical setting?
That is a very specific, strict metric. It doesn't mean the patient simply felt a reduction in pain or felt a bit better. It means that when doctors reviewed the CT scans and MRIs, the physical tumors mathematically shrank by a significant amount.
Oh, so it's visible on a scan?
Yes. So for roughly a third of these 26 patients, the drug successfully wedged into the protein crevices and caused the tumors to physically reduce in size.
You know, a third of the group doesn't sound like a magic bullet. But considering these patients were entirely out of options, how much extra time does that tumor shrinkage actually buy them?
Well, the report lists a median duration of response at 8.2 months, a median progression-free survival at 8.5 months, and a median overall survival at 13.1 months.
Okay, these survival metrics represent entirely different phases of a patient's journey. Let's separate them out. Here's where it gets really interesting.
Let's hear it.
I always think of progression-free survival as pausing the clock. It's the amount of time that a patient is taking the drug where the cancer just doesn't get any worse. It's not growing and it's not spreading. The enemy's advance is completely frozen in place.
That's a perfect way to describe it. For these patients, the median time the clock was paused was 8.5 months.
And then there's overall survival.
Right. Overall survival is the total time the patient lived from the start of the treatment. For this first group, the median was 13.1 months.
Now, if you're listening to this and hearing 13 months of overall survival, you might be thinking, that's it, just over a year.
It doesn't sound like much out of context.
Exactly. But we have to remember the grim reality of pancreatic cancer. When standard treatments have failed, the timeline is often measured in very short weeks.
It is incredibly fast moving.
So gaining an extra 8.5 months where the disease is totally frozen, that is a lifetime for these families.
It is genuinely invaluable time. And the report gives us a second subgroup to analyze as well, which gives us even more context.
Okay, tell me about this second group.
This group had 38 patients, and they looked at a wider variety of mutations, specific genetic typos known as G12, G13, and Q61.
So a slightly broader target. What were the results for that broader group?
The objective response, the actual physical shrinking of the tumors we talked about, was 29%.
Okay, slightly lower than the 35%.
Yeah, slightly lower. But the median duration of response was exactly the same, 8.2 months. Progression-free survival was basically identical at 8.1 months, and their median overall survival was actually slightly longer, coming in at 15.6 months.
That's fascinating. But, you know, the text includes a range of numbers in parentheses right next to those percentages. It calls it the 95% confidence interval.
Ah, yes, the confidence intervals.
Yeah, for the first group's objective response of 35%, the text says 95% confidence interval, 17 to 56. Why do the researchers include that massive range instead of just giving us the clean 35%?
Well, because a median or a clean percentage is just a middle point. It's a really useful shorthand for a headline, sure, but it doesn't tell the whole messy story of human biology.
It's too simple.
Right. The 95% confidence interval is the statistical way of saying we are 95% sure that if we gave this drug to the entire population of people with this exact condition, the true average response rate would fall somewhere between 17% and 56%.
So it highlights the massive variability of the human body.
Exactly. For some patients in the trial, the drug struggled to find purchase and didn't work well at all. They might be closer to that 17%. But for others, the response was incredibly robust, well above that 35% mark, pushing toward 56%.
Wow.
It forces us to look at the data as a spectrum of real human outcomes, not just one fixed number.
And that wide variance applies to the survival stats too, right?
Uh-huh.
In the second group, the duration of response was a median of 8.2 months, but the confidence interval was 3.8 to 8.8.
Yes. While the median gives doctors a helpful benchmark to set expectations in the exam room, the reality for the individual patient receiving the prescription could be vastly different.
It really depends on the person.
Completely. One patient might only get 3 or 4 months of pause time before the cancer outsmarts the drug, while another might get nearly 9 months or even more.
So when we step back and look at all of this together, we have a patient population that historically has had literally no options left. They've endured brutal, untargeted chemotherapies that ultimately failed.
Yeah, they've been through a lot.
And now they can take an oral pill at home. They absolutely face a very real 30% risk of severe disruptive side effects, like mucositis.
It's not an easy path.
No. But in exchange for taking on that suffering, roughly a third of them see their tumors physically shrink. They gain a median of around 8 months where the disease is completely paused, leading to a median overall survival of well over a year.
And those months gained are just a seismic shift for pancreatic cancer research.
They really are.
When you are fighting a disease that historically moves with devastating, unstoppable speed, securing 8.5 months of progression-free survival is a triumph.
It's time they wouldn't have had otherwise.
Exactly. That is 8.5 months to spend with family, to travel, or to just wake up without the cancer actively advancing. It is a profoundly meaningful step forward. And the report's conclusion summarizes this balance perfectly.
What does the conclusion say?
It states that daraxonrasib was associated with treatment-related adverse events of grade 3 or higher in one-third of patients, but that genuine anti-tumor activity was definitively reported.
So what does this all mean? We started this deep dive with the premise of decoding this trial, balancing the hope against the harsh realities.
And we definitely found both.
Yeah, the synthesis seems to be that the reality is indeed harsh. The physical toll on the digestive tract and the body is steep, but the hope is genuinely, quantifiably real. The medicine wedged into the crevice, the tumor shrank, the clock was paused.
It is absolutely a significant clinical breakthrough for pancreatic cancer. But you know, the most exciting part of this text isn't just about one specific disease.
No.
No, it's about the mechanism itself.
Right.
We mentioned earlier that the smooth, featureless RAS mutation was considered completely undruggable for decades.
Right, the smooth billiard ball.
Exactly. This drug, this oral multi-selective inhibitor, proved that the lock actually can be picked. It successfully capitalized on the microscopic flexing of a protein that was previously thought to be invincible.
It proved the vault has a weakness.
It did. And that leaves us with a massive, incredibly exciting question to ponder as we look at the future of medicine.
Which?
If scientists can design a blueprint that successfully targets, wedges into, and jams the undruggable RAS mutation, what other so-called undruggable mutations are out there?
Oh, wow. I hadn't even thought of that.
There are countless genetic typos across entirely different types of cancers and entirely different diseases that we've known about for years but could never touch.
Because they were also too smooth or too hidden.
Right. But if this exact same blueprint, this new way of exploiting a protein's temporary physical shape as it flexes, can be adapted, how many other unpickable locks are suddenly within our reach?
That is an amazing thought to leave on. That bank vault we talked about at the beginning, the one welded shut and buried under concrete, it is still a formidable, terrifying obstacle. But for the first time in a long time, we are finally seeing a real, measurable crack in the door.